With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily for Thursday, April 22nd, 2021. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news, and then we're going to be presenting an interview with the creator of a new Hulu series called Sasquatch. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm the senior writer at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film writer Huai Tran Bui.
Hey, everyone.
Hi, Aishi. It's just you and me again today for now.
The best. Best team up.
Yes. So Jacob is going to join us a little bit later on to present that interview that I mentioned. But let's get into the news. So one thing we have not talked about yet in any sort of detail on Slash Film Daily is the Shang-Chi trailer, which came out, I want to say, several days ago at this point.
It was Monday, I remember, because it dropped like at 8 a.m.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was, I was like, I'm still waking up.
Yeah, 8 a.m. Eastern. It was like very, early in the morning. We were sort of like, shaking off the cobwebs from the weekend. It was like, oh, we're diving straight into Marvelville here. Okay, all right. So I guess there was a lot of news on Monday's episode of the show, and we just didn't cover it then. But okay, so all excuses aside, HT, what did you think about this trailer?
I liked it. I was very intrigued by the wuxia inspired action sequences that were scattered throughout the trailer. Wuxia is, by what I refer to as wuxia, is the martial arts subgenre of filmmaking that is you can see that is in films like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Hero. I don't know why I'm blanking right now, but yes,
colorful, those are like the two big prime examples.
Colorful, balletic films such as those that have this sort of high fantasy approach to martial arts and were quite popular in the early 2000s. And Daniel Destin Cretton, I keep mixing up his name. Daniel Cretton.
That's right.
He, I think, spoke about taking inspiration from wuxia films. So seeing that play out in the trailer was really exciting. I was really excited to see Tony Leung. I've been talking about him a lot on the water cooler lately. I don't know why I've been like on a Tony Leung binge, but he looks great in this trailer. We know that he's playing the Mandarin or some form of the Mandarin, like the Marvel MCU version of the Mandarin, the true one after Ben Kingsley's imposter, although I actually am on the side of liking that twist.
I was going to ask you about that. I'm sure we've talked about that on some podcasts before, but I couldn't remember where you stood on the great Mandarin controversy of 2013.
Iron Man 3 is great, actually, and the Mandarin twist in that is one of the best parts. All those Marvel bros who are like, it's not the real Mandarin. It's such a funny, subversive way of undercutting the troubling stereotypes, like Asian stereotypes that are attached to that character since its inception. So I thought that was really smart and really funny. And all of the people who poo-pooed it are wrong.
Well, HT, this truly is the greatest podcast team, because I'm definitely on the same page with you there. Mm-hmm. And I really think I'm even more glad now that they played that card the way they did in 2013, because Marvel as a company was not ready at that point to handle the cultural sensitivity and all of that kind of stuff. Like they were still being overseen by a different regime, and Kevin Feige didn't have quite as much say in everything. And it seems like, I know people have been frustrated with Marvel's representation over the years, but I think now it's sort of a better late than never scenario. And I'm much more open to the idea of seeing, Marvel sort of attempt to tackle a story like this in 2021 than I would have been in 2013, because I just feel like they would have bungled it back then. They just weren't prepared as a company to deal with complex stuff like that.
And I still am kind of trepidatious over whether they can appropriately tackle Asian representation, specifically Chinese representation in Shang-Chi. This is their first Asian superhero, played by Simu Liu, who is great. He's great, apparently, in Kim's Convenience. I haven't seen him in that, but everyone I know who watches that sitcom loves him and loves it. And it's their majority Asian-led cast. It has a lot of inspiration from Asian led genres like wuxia, but their past attempts at sidestepping or tackling representation have been kind of lukewarm to me. I think specifically of Doctor Strange and their sidestepping of the was it the great one?
The ancient one.
Tilda Swinton's character by gender bending the character to attempt to sidestep like that retrograde stereotype, but then they in the process whitewashed it. So I'm still a little bit. I'm not sure how they'll go about it, but the trailer looks great. I'm excited about Tony Leung, and I do think that the visuals. Like the colors are a little washed out still in that typical Marvel way, but I'm anticipating how the entire thing will look in the end.
Yeah, I'm very curious about the combination of fighting styles in this movie, because as you mentioned, that wuxia stuff, you can see those elements where like, you know, again, for people who might not be super familiar with that term, it's almost as if characters can like fly around while doing martial arts. Yeah. While participating in martial arts.
It's very balletic. It's physics defying.
But there's also moments where, you know, there's a moment on like a subway or a bus where Liu's character just like fights as if it's in, you know, a Jackie Chan movie or something like that. So it's not like every single fight scene across the board is going to look the same in this movie. So I'm very curious to see what that blend is like and how that sort of lends itself to the movie's overall feel. If it ends up feeling a little disjointed and sort of chaotic because these fighting styles are, you know, so disparate and spread throughout the movie, or if like each fighting style is going to be sort of pinned to a different type of character and like their skill set or something like that, which is kind of interesting. I don't know if I've ever seen that done before. Certainly not on a, you know, in a mainstream American movie like this. Like Hollywood movie rather. I'm very curious to see what this is like. And I think this movie comes out in September. So I'm sure we'll be talking about it much, much more as we get a little bit closer. But yeah, you know, after skipping mentioning that earlier, just wanted to chime in with our two cents about that real quick. So let's get into some other news items here. Sticking with, sort of adjacent news to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Disney and Sony have reached a licensing deal. This was announced last night. And it involves, basically, it will result in the Spider-Man movies that Sony has been co-producing with Disney and Marvel ending up on Disney Plus. It took us so long to sort of parse the details of what this stuff means because it's all like corporate speak. And recently, Sony struck a deal with Netflix for its new releases. You and I actually talked about that on a recent episode of this podcast where Sony's new movies from next year will arrive on Netflix about 18 months after they premiere in theaters. So we talked about that. And then this deal is sort of like on top of that. After the Netflix window has closed, Sony's new movies will now be sort of handed over to Disney to disseminate as Disney will through, you know, across all of Disney's platforms. So we're talking, you know, Disney Plus, Hulu, ABC, Freeform, FX, the Disney channels, and National Geographic. So a lot of big Sony movies, including the Spider-Man, you know, Far From Home and Homecoming and the upcoming Spider-Man movie and stuff like Morbius and Venom, as well as other Sony titles like Jumanji and Hotel Transylvania. Those are all sort of being lumped into this big deal that is going to be lasting for 5 years. So basically after, you know, a year plus after these movies premiere in theaters, people will be able to watch them, you know, under the Disney umbrella, these big Sony movies. So you can read about, you know, all the specifics of this story in in the actual article itself, which we'll link to obviously in the show notes. Okay, so I just wanted to mention that because it was a sort of a big deal last night. But let's get into a show that I never thought that we would actually see happen, which is a spinoff of How I Met Your Mother. Actually, tell me about that.
Yeah, we're going to be getting the counterpart to How I Met Your Mother, How I Met Your Father, a new comedy series from Isaac Apteker and Elizabeth Berger, who are behind This Is Us and Love, Victor. And it's coming to Hulu with with Hilary Duff set to star, fresh off the doomed Lizzie McGuire series that was initially set to have its revival on Disney Plus before getting axed for not being family friendly enough. But maybe we'll get a chance at a Lizzie McGuire sequel after all if Hilary Duff gets her Lizzie McGuire cast members into How I Met Your Father, which is a 10-episode comedy, or at least this first season is, about a woman named Sophie who is telling her son the story of how she met his father, a story that catapults us back to the year 2021, where Sophie and her close-knit group of friends are in the midst of figuring out who they are, what they want out of life, and how to fall in love in the age of dating apps and limitless options. Hilary Duff is also serving as producer on this series, which is a Hulu original and will be a multi and single camera approach similar to its predecessor. And original How I Met Your Mother creators Carter Bays and Craig Thomas will also be executive producing alongside Apteker and Berger.
So the big question, HT, is do we know if any of the How I Met Your Mother cast are going to be appearing in this?
There's no confirmation or details yet on the How I Met Your Mother cast popping up in this, even though it says it's a sequel. There's no indication that Sophie is related in any way to the characters of How I Met Your Mother. Mm-hmm. It just seems to be taking the premise of How I Met Your Mother and making it a female protagonist instead of a male protagonist. And this isn't the first time that the world at large, not the world at large, 20th television has attempted to spin off this How I Met Your Mother property with a female lead. The first time being How I Met Your Dad with Greta Gerwig, originally set to star and write for the series. And it even went to pilot before it got it didn't get picked up and kind of disappeared into the ether. And Greta Gerwig went on to direct Lady Bird and Little Women and become an Oscar-winning director.
Yeah, that's great stuff. I'm so glad for her that she did not get stuck in sitcom land for many, many years, because while I appreciated How I Met Your Mother, it definitely was one of those shows that went on for a long, long time. And just to be deprived of Lady Bird and Little Women is sort of a heart-crushing like alternate reality.
Yeah,
and
I'm very glad that we don't live in that. Yeah, in the scenario, we got the better end of the deal.
Did you watch How I Met Your Mother when it was on?
I did. I was really into it, actually. I watched every single episode. I was watching it live. And yes, I was very disappointed by the ending.
Did you watch Lizzie McGuire? You mentioned that as, you know, the big Hilary Duff show.
Yeah, I did actually watch it when it was on Disney Channel. Even though I didn't have Disney Channel, I would watch it at like my cousin's house. And sometimes I think it would air on ABC on Saturdays. I never watched all of the episodes, but I did like Lizzie McGuire. It very much was geared towards my demographic, which was middle schoolers growing up in the early 2000s. And it was really charming. It was like a fourth wall breaking series where like her subconscious, it takes the form of this animated character, and she's just a very like an ordinary girl going through the ups and downs of puberty. And Hilary Duff is very charming in it. I was actually quite excited for a sequel. I think the revival had a lot of promise. The idea of Lizzie McGuire in her late 20s, early 30s, navigating New York sounded really exciting to me, and I was interested to see like where the show would take the characters. And Hilary Duff had actually tried to get Hulu to pick up the series after Disney Plus like dropped it, as they did with Love, Victor, but it was not meant to be. But maybe at this point she can just get the Lizzie McGuire people over to to have your father.
I think that would be fun. So you know, being or if not a full-on fan, and at least enjoying both of these shows at various points in your life, what do you think about Hilary Duff as the lead of How I Met Your Father? Is this something that you're actually like interested in?
Sure. I mean, How I Met Your Mother was really just a Friends redux anyways. Mm-hmm. And it's a very universal premise, a bunch of friends navigating love and life. And that kind of thing that kind of premise can be made or broken based on the talent of its stars and its writers. And I think How I Met Your Mother had a great cast in it, and some it was, and good writers, except they botched the ending. And Lizzie McGuire, Hilary Duff is a talented actress. So if they build a good cast around her, then sure, I'd be interested in it.
Cool. All right. So some news that broke today. Disney has found a director for its new Haunted Mansion movie. And that director is Justin Simien, who directed Dear White People, which is a 2014 indie movie that has since gone on to be adapted into a Netflix series, which is very good and underrated. And I feel like not enough people talk about that show. It was a little bumpy at certain moments, but overall, I think that show is really, really good. And I encourage everybody to check it out if you have not seen it. Justin Simien, you know, Dear White People is like the thing that he is best known for. But last year he directed this movie called Bad Hair, which is a horror satire that debuted at Sundance 2020 and got picked up by Hulu. I guess it was sort of a big deal for Hulu when it debuted on that service last year. So he has done some horror stuff before. I'm not entirely sure what his take on Disney's Haunted Mansion is going to be, or how far Disney will let him sort of push into that horror direction, because obviously it's a Disney movie. It's going to be a little bit more family friendly than a full blown sort of horror kind of film. But Justin Simien is already sort of in the Disney family, quote unquote, because he is the creator and showrunner of Lando, which is the upcoming Star Wars show centered on Lando Calrissian. So I guess Disney had been wanting to work with him on a movie for quite some time now. He had met on multiple films and pitched them an idea for this Haunted Mansion film, and they really liked his take. So we have no idea what that is going to be. Katie Dippold, who as a writer for Parks and Recreation, she wrote The Heat and Ghostbusters Answer the Call, wrote the most recent draft of this movie's script. So that kind of leads me to believe that it's going to be a little bit more comedic, because that's sort of what she has been known for thus far. But man, I tell you, like, seeing the 180 that Craig Mazin did from, you know, writing stuff like the Hangover sequels to Chernobyl really has me like pumping my brakes on making sort of like ill-informed guesses about what writers are going to do based on what they've done before, because that turnaround was just so dramatic for him that I'm like, oh man, well, just because Katie Dippold has done comedic stuff in the past doesn't necessarily mean that this is going to be a comedy. So what do you think about this, HT? What do you think about Justin Simien directing a Haunted Mansion movie?
I have not seen the original Haunted Mansion movie, and I have not seen Dear White People, so I don't know if I can really comment on this, but I know a lot of people really like Dear White People. It seemed really smart and funny and timely, so sure.
I forgot to mention, you rightly said the earlier Haunted Mansion movie, that film came out in 2003 and it starred Eddie Murphy, and this actually has nothing to do with that. It's not going to be, I think some outlets, maybe Variety, referred to it as a remake, but I don't think it's going to be following the same template as that film, because Deadline said that it's supposed to be a completely separate thing where it can sort of stand on its own 2 feet. So it's not going to be connected to that movie, which I think that the Haunted Mansion movie that came out in 2003 came out in the same year as the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie. And that film showed exactly like the right way to adapt a theme park ride, which, was surprisingly great. And this movie, this Haunted Mansion movie from 2003 was the wrong way to do it.
From what I remember, and based on the trailers that I saw, is that it was a very goofy showcase for Eddie Murphy that kind of just fell flat for a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of a missed opportunity. But Guillermo del Toro has been like, attached to or in conversation to direct or write a Haunted Mansion movie for a long, long time. Or like 10 years ago, I think, at Comic-Con, they announced that he was going to be involved with a movie. And obviously that has stalled over the years and not happened. So this is not the Del Toro movie. I don't think he has, his DNA in anything of this project. I think it's like he wrote a couple drafts of a script that ended up not getting made. So this is a whole separate thing. But all right, so let's talk about our last news story of the day, which is Netflix spending a lot of money on content in 2021. What do we know, HT?
Yeah, Netflix revealed in its first quarter earnings report that it plans to spend over $17 billion on content in 2021. They are basically making up for production delays from COVID-19 in 2020 and plan to spend even more on original titles, TV series, international titles. And this earnings report basically goes into the reach that its originals from 2020 met, such as their shows like Fate the Winx Saga, which reached 57 million households, Ginny and Georgia, 52 million, etc. So their outreach is still doing okay, but they are definitely planning to make up for lost time from last year, spending way more than they did in 2020, in which they spent $11.7 billion, and in 2019, in which they spent $13.9 billion.
Yeah, so from essentially 14 to, there was a little bit of a dip, obviously, in 2020, naturally, down to about 12, and then now bumping back up to 17. I mean, I remember when, I want to say it was like 8 billion was the number, like several years ago, and we were all like,
God, so much money.
This is wild. And now it's 17 billion in 1 year, which is just, oh my God. Just thinking about like how dramatically Netflix has changed the entire industry and become like the studio that produces more content than pretty much any other, you know, like all of the major Hollywood studios put together. It's just wild to think about. Like sometimes I just, you know, we cover this stuff every day. So the specialness of it kind of wears off, but you're sort of like in the trenches, just like, you know, oh my God, Fate the Winx Saga is coming up or whatever. But like taking a step back every once in a while and just being like, man, this company that used to just like mail DVDs to people is now like the dominant force in Hollywood. It's really, really wild to think
about.
Speaking
of, I found some old DVDs that—
Did you really?
Netflix, yeah. At my parents' house, like we used to be subscribed to the Netflix mailing thing way before they went to streaming. So we were one of the first adopters of Netflix. And by the way, they should have rewarded us for being such longtime customers, because we just spent more money because we had to do the streaming and DVD, yeah. And then we had just ended up going to streaming because it was cheaper. But yeah, I found some old ones. One of them was American Psycho. And I was I guess I can't return some videotapes.
Oh, what a great, great joke. I love that. That's a great place for us to end, I think, and a great place for us to bring in Jacob Hall, who is the managing editor of SlashFilm.com, who's going to be presenting an interview for us. So HT, I'll say goodbye to you for now. So since we almost never do this anymore, where can people find more of your work on the internet if they want to check you out?
Well, you can find me writing every day at SlashFilm.com. I'm on Twitter at HTrambui. And you can find me on my new podcast, Trekking Through Time and Space, available on all podcasting platforms, and now with a newly launched Patreon at patreon.com/trekkingthroughtimeandspace.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, HT.
Thanks.
All right, Jacob, welcome. How are you?
It's one of those days, but you should watch Sasquatch, Ben. It'll make your bad day seem like a great day in comparison.
Okay, yeah. So you've talked about this before in a water cooler episode, maybe, or maybe like right after you interviewed the director. But this interview is now up on SlashFilm.com. I will link to it in the show notes. But I wanted to drop the audio in here and let people listen to your conversation with the director of this new show. So why don't you just like tee this up for us, Jacob? Tell us what we need to know about Sasquatch.
Yeah, Sasquatch is a really compelling day ruining, but also incredibly entertaining true crime doc series. They're on 3 episodes streaming on Hulu right now. And it's about a journalist who decided to investigate a story he heard 25 years earlier while working on an illegal marijuana farm in Northern California, where he overheard a discussion about how a Bigfoot apparently attacked a neighboring pot farm, killed 3 people, and got away. And he decided to investigate and see what actually happened. Was it Bigfoot or was it something else? And the resulting investigation is tracked entirely by a documentary crew. And the director, Joshua Rofe, I spoke to him, and oh boy, does he have stories about how this was a dangerous and seemingly very, sometimes exciting, sometimes very boring shoot, but the results speak for themselves, I think.
Yeah, I I have read this interview and I was just sort of like my jaw was on the floor at like some of the stories that he alludes to here. So I guess without further ado, let's just let people listen to them themselves. Here is Joshua Ruff talking about Sasquatch.
No worries.
I'm hitting record.
This is the day of computer troubles over here. So right in line.
Yeah. Well, I watched all three episodes. I think this is fantastic. I couldn't get enough of it. So I gotta
Thank
ask,
you so much.
At what point did you enter this story? I mean, were you here from the beginning, or did you get a phone call saying, hey, I have something going on? Did you hear, where did you come into this?
Yeah, so this was sort of my harebrained idea to pursue, sort of concoction and to pursue. Basically, in February 2018, I had dinner with a friend, Zach Greger, who's one of the exec producers on this, and he suggested that I listen to a podcast called Sasquatch Chronicles. And so I listened to about 11 episodes in 4 days. And what I was immediately struck by and also obsessed with was the fact that I was sensing visceral fear from everybody who was calling in telling their Sasquatch encounter or sighting stories. And my brain started to do that thing where I knew that this was going to be my next project. I didn't know what it was going to look like. I knew it was going to be Sasquatch centric. And so I just sort of wondered, God, if I could find a murder mystery that is somehow wrapped up or intertwined with a Sasquatch story, that could be really compelling. And so I reached out to David Holthaus, who is the main subject in this series and one of the producers on it. And David's a colleague of mine for a number of years already at this point. And he's been an investigative journalist for over 25 years and a gonzo journalist at that. So he's one of those people who's really seen and done a lot of wild things. And I sent him a text that said, hey, this is the craziest text I'm gonna send you for the next 5 years. If it exists, I would like to find a murder mystery that's wrapped up in a Sasquatch story and pursue that as the next project. And he wrote me right back and he said, I love it. I got one. I'll call you in 5. And then he proceeded to tell me this story that he heard in person in 1993 about a Sasquatch murdering 3 people on a weed farm in Northern California. And as soon as he told me that, I said, okay, we're on to something and let's see what happens.
Yeah, and were you aware at that point that David would be your protagonist? Because the series really does play with him being the lead character, and thank God for you, he's a really compelling camera-ready guy.
Yeah, I again, having known David for a few years, he is just somebody who it was just obvious to me that he was extremely compelling. I don't know if you've ever listened to his This American Life episode, but I would highly recommend that. He's an incredible storyteller, and he's a person who just, I think really due to his life experiences, he just has a ton of gravitas and, you know, he's charismatic in that sort of quiet, almost Gene Hackman-like way. I knew right away that I wanted to follow him, hunting the origin of this story.
So it sounds like when you contacted him that the mystery hadn't been solved yet, because without spoiling anything, the documentary really follows the investigation actually unfurling. It's not like it's not presented as a thing that has a solution at the start. You see things being solved. So was that the actual process of filming? You actually really filming alongside the investigation as opposed to editing it that way?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there were there were so many times where, you know, you just hit roadblocks and you wonder if you're even going to get anywhere. I mean, we had months and months of roadblocks where, you know, an investigation it's not always compelling. It's full of so many lulls and it's full of so many moments where you've come up completely empty handed. And, you know, a hunch that you had about something, you go and you chase it for 3 weeks and you realize you were just dead wrong. And so this series was truly following David on that path as it was happening.
I feel like you use that to your strengths. I mean, that some of the roadblocks are become really compelling side notes in this story. And even a lot of the diversions you take, I mean, the Bigfoot experts, for example, you interview, are just these really fascinating diversions. It really creates the idea of getting lost in the mystery as opposed to, you know, presenting something solid and tidy.
Yeah, I mean, I think if anybody who's attempts to solve a mystery or to get to the bottom of something that other people maybe don't want you to get to the bottom of, they know that you as the investigator, you as the filmmaker, you are never in control. That may sound, like a negative or some sort of a drawback, but it's actually a strength. Because if you give yourself over to that process, you're going to meet fascinating people along the way. You're going to go down certain, you know, rabbit holes and alleys that even though they won't spit you out where maybe you want to be spit out, it's going to be wild and it's going to add a lot of sort of color and texture to the path. I will say though, Jacob, that was something that we had to sort of get used to. I know David is more used to that as an investigator, but even as a filmmaker, just knowing I'm going to go on a shoot this week and I might come back with nothing. That's actually okay. And if we do it enough times, little by little, you know, these breadcrumbs will start to add up. And what ended up happening is we went from shoots where maybe we learned a thing or two, and I'm laying up at night having an existential crisis, knowing that I'm a failure attempting to make this and I'll never be allowed to make anything again, to then, you know, five of those trips, you know, you got three things each time. Well, now we're on trip number seven, and every single thing we're getting is just a stick of dynamite. And only by going through the prior process could we get to that point.
Yeah, there are moments in this series that feel like David's in legitimate danger, where he's wearing what appears to be hidden cameras, where he's meeting people in clandestine locations. Did David buff you from that, or did you ever feel like you were also in danger?
I think we never felt safe when we were up there. And there was this sort of overwhelming feeling of, I don't want to overstay my welcome. David is the one who truly faced the most danger, because there were times where, and some of this is in the series, you'll hear him recounted in a voice memo or in a sort of pickup interview after something happened. But there were times where he was going to go meet a potential source. They changed the location on him multiple times. And now he's gone from meeting somebody in a public place at 3 p.m. to he's going to meet somebody at a bar or a restaurant at around, 10:30, 11. And it's in a totally different town. And oh, by the way, that bar or restaurant, it's actually closed. And it's going to be us and eight other people who you didn't know were going to be there. And so he was definitely in some potentially hairy situations, many, many, many times, including just being up in the hidden camera footage you're referencing, being up there in those mountains, in those woods. If something had happened to him, there's no way we would have ever known.
Were there like tips you learned from David, knowing that you felt this way? And now as a filmmaker, what are you armed with now? Like, what knowledge do you have to go into a similarly dangerous situation that you learned from making this?
you're lucky if you can get out once. Yeah, no, I think you just have to, and it's something that David mentions in the show, just, real time, constant, on the fly risk analysis. It is just that sort of checking in with each other, on a regular basis is something that that was just really a big part of the process. I think moving forward that is definitely something that we will continue to to sort of lean on, given if a project calls for it.
Yeah, and when you set up to make a murder doc about Sasquatch, did you realize you would have to do a crash course in Northern California pot farms? Because I had no knowledge of the history of this area, no knowledge of that culture. And I was utterly transfixed learning this incredibly niche, but also incredibly dark pocket of American culture. Like, at what point did you realize, oh, this is a documentary is also about this as opposed to just being about Bigfoot?
Yeah, no, that's awesome to hear. Once David started talking to people, particularly in the world of of cannabis growing, it became clear that all of that was going to be a big piece. But going in, I thought of this initially as a somewhat quirkier murder mystery, something that would not have the danger and even the pathos that we think it ended up having. So much of this was a discovery in the process of making it, which, you know, it was at times it was brutal and terrifying, and at the same time always just so invigorating and really just an adrenalized experience, particularly when we were shooting it.
Yeah, and it's structured, it's paced like a 70s conspiracy thriller. It really, I mean, I've seen enough true crime doc series. I mean, there's a reason why they're popular, and it's because a lot of them do follow a very familiar beat format. Whereas this has the pacing and feel of fiction, while it's not. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about finding the story, the narrative in this real footage, and crafting it so it feels like it could have been fiction, even though it's clearly not.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm going to mention McCabe and Mrs. Miller, even though this doesn't feel like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, but that is a film that my DP and I spoke about in terms of people sort of really just in the elements. And just the way the camera was used, the way a zoom lens can be used, not going overboard, but, utilizing that sort of 70s zoom at the right moment in the woods. And then also thinking about the parallax view, and then also thinking about Fincher's Zodiac, which is one of my favorites of all time, and Bong Joon-ho's Memories of a Murder was another one that was definitely in my mind as we were shooting and even editing. And I'm a 70s movie freak, and like so many of us are, and I always felt this one particularly, I felt it even had more in common with, a combination of 70s paranoid thriller and graphic novel, sort of mashup than a documentary. And I didn't want it to feel like, I was less interested in it feeling like a doc. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to feel just sort of a little funkier than that, which is what the story really sort of tells you it's going to be,
Yeah. Is the graphic novel idea the reason why you want animation instead of reenactments for those scenes?
Yeah. So we were discussing early on, all right, how are we going to visually express this? And Mark Duplass said, what about animation? And my reaction initially was, I'm not crazy about animation in docs, actually. It just hasn't been something that to that point had really spoken to me. And then they put us in contact with an animator that had worked with them before, with Duplass Brothers. And he's up in the Pacific Northwest. His name's Drew Christie. And so I spoke to Drew and I just said, hey, I'm going to send you 2 minutes of David telling this story about what happened that night in the fall of 93. And I don't want to give you direction. I just want you to do your thing and let's see what happens. And about a week and a half, 2 weeks later, he sends me back 90 seconds of animation that I don't even know if a frame changed from that test to the final show. He captured and created, a world so beautifully, and I felt like it. I'm sure I probably mentioned to him graphic novel feel, but that's it. And so once I saw his test, that was that we were sort of off and running, in that sense.
And another thing I really appreciate here, and this is I'll try to dance around any late game spoilers, people who haven't watched seen the series yet, is that this ends up being a series that's about how we make monsters, either, legendary myths, but also the ones in our day-to-day lives. Can you talk about going through your footage, going through this investigation and realizing, oh, there's actually a really strong thematic point here and building the movie to come to that, or building the series to come to that?
Yeah, it's the deeper we got, the more we realized that there were many monsters in this story, and what they were what they were all consistently doing was wielding fear. And, you know, folklore, if you really start to dig into it, it's always intertwined with fear. You know, and again, I'm going to try and do that similar dance that you're doing here, so I want to be careful, but people are terrifying. Sure, the boogeyman is terrifying, but really it's, you know, your neighbor is terrifying, potentially, you know? That person that you may run into in the woods is terrifying. And monsters, monsters are real, and sometimes they look like us. And sometimes they look like Bigfoot. And I think our show really straddles the line of sort of which one of those are in control at certain moments.
All right. Well, not to do too hard of a pivot from, you know, a thematic question to like a technical question, but this is just a something I never. You're my first true crime doc interview, so I gotta know, how do you responsibly recreate phone calls? I mean, like, and you make that note at each of us saying, hey, somebody's been recreated for you know, whatever reasons. What's the process of like either re-recording those or modifying them? I need, like, what's the step-by-step journalistic integrity / you know, filmmaking integrity aspect of making sure those phone calls work and do justice to the story?
Sure. I mean, you know, they're all real calls. And there were you know, specific modifications that were made. I won't take it further because we did that to protect the safety of certain individuals. And so it really was all in the name of trying to make sure that certain folks didn't get hurt.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. I guess my last question, as I start wrapping this up. Well, went on a slightly lighter note. After all of this, and after discovering some very human monsters, of course, making this, where do you fall on Bigfoot? Real, yay or nay, at this point, after all this time?
Yeah, it's a very fair question. Going in, I was 100% no. And then I spent time up in those woods, and David really captured it, I thought, really, really eloquently. And it's in the first episode. And he says something to the effect of there is an element of the supernatural that seems to run at a higher vibration up there when you're in those woods, where, God, those trees, they're so big. And if you're deep enough in that forest, you'd think, oh, yeah, a brontosaurus could walk by at any moment. And by the same token, you start to understand, you know, how and why people could maybe believe that there is a Sasquatch running around. Your senses take on, you know, sort of what I would almost describe as a parallel version to you know, that is then heightened. I found myself questioning sounds and smells more than I probably would in my everyday life. So I got to see it to be able to know something is real for me. But when you're in those woods, all of a sudden it seems like anything is possible.
All right, that's a good place to end this. Thank you so much, Joshua. I'm really excited to talk to you. It's a great project, and I'm looking forward to talking about it a little bit more as it comes out.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Thank you, Jacob.
You have a good day.
All right. Take care.
All right. So, Jacob, before we wrap up, do you have any final thoughts about Sasquatch? I'm sure people are probably intrigued now to watch the show. And as you mentioned, all three episodes are on Hulu right now. Any final thoughts for you, maybe after you've seen this whole series? What do you think about it?
I wish more true crime series were shot like this, where the crew is an active participant in the investigation, where it's not just, hey, we're recapping a murder from 30 years ago. It's we're on the ground with the investigator and actually getting into the nitty gritty of what it's like to actually investigate, what it feels like when you run down an alley that goes nowhere, or you reach a dead end, or when you find lots of evidence, but don't know how it adds up. I think Sasquatch really allows you to get lost in how frustrating, confusing, and terrifying solving a mystery can be. And I really hope people check it out. I think you can watch it all in one evening. I think it's really hard to stop watching once you start.
Jacob, I just realized, listening to you talk just now, it reminded me of Wind of Change, which is a podcast that you and I both listened to, and you just mentioned on, I think it was yesterday's water cooler episode of this show. Wind of Change reminds me a little bit of Sasquatch in that it is that sort of like investigative story. It's about a journalist who like heard whispers of something happening long ago and like devoting an entire show to, you know, peeling back the layers and trying to get to the truth behind this thing. Had you made that connection before? Is that just like a particular type of storytelling that you find yourself drawn to?
I did not make the connection now, but apparently I like one thing only, Ben, which is true crime investigation stories where you're in there with the investigator. But seriously, I think that if you've seen a lot of true crime on Netflix or on other services or stations or networks, wherever we're calling them these days, I think you'd be pleasantly surprised by how cinematic Sasquatch is and how in the interview when we discussed, you know, his filmmaking inspirations and 70s paranoia thrillers. It's not just lip service. This Sasquatch, I think, really feels like how I hope more true crime shows treat themselves. They feel like actual cinema as opposed to, you know, talking heads explaining about a sad murder.
Yeah, well, I've definitely added it to my queue, and hopefully some of our listeners have as well. So that is Sasquatch. It's available on Hulu right now, and you can find more about all these stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked inside the show notes of this episode. Slashfilm Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps, and send us your feedback, questions, comments, and concerns at peter@slashfilm.com. Also, if you have mailbag topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can send those to peter@slashfilm.com as well. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends, spread the word. Thank you all for listening, and we will be back tomorrow to discuss the season finale of The Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save